With the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. Nina, a new graduate from fashion design in college, gladly accepts the offer to have her palm read as a graduation gift. Smiling, the palm reader tells Nina that she has a long lifeline as she traces it on her hand. As soon as the words are uttered, the palm reader's facial expression turns to one of fear. In broken English, she whispers, "Break, very bad break in middle of life. Maybe you die." Nina does come close to death at age 34 when she and her family are involved in a serious auto accident. She assumes she has successfully cheated the death that the palm reader prophesied. Unfortunately, the sinister and tragic break in the lifeline and its deliverer are yet to be revealed. The book that we're featuring this evening is Maybe You Die, the true story of a couple living the all-American nightmare, with my special guest, author Nancy Lee. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for agreeing to this interview, Nancy Lee.
Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you so much. This is a remarkable story, and let's get right to this, Maybe You Die. You open this fascinating book with your experience with a psychic named Mary Kubiachi, a 60-year-old woman you say is very mysterious. And you at that time had your aspirations, you were a fashion designer. Tell us what happens at this fateful meeting with Mary Kubiachi, this reading. What does she say?
That was my last day of school, and she was going to give me a gift, and she read my palm and told me this and the shocking news that maybe I would die. And then suddenly she just turned her demeanor and says, "But if you live, you live a long time." And with that, my professor heard her and took her by the arm and was dragging her up the stairs, warning her she's not supposed to be telling fortunes.
Right.
And then the book starts. Yeah, go ahead.
You also say that you asked her when this thing might happen, this event might happen. She said maybe 30 or 40. But like as you say, if you live, you live long life. Now, in the book, you segue right to you being in the hospital in dire straits. Tell us what your feelings are and tell us your predicament at that time. Why are you there?
Yeah, the book starts at my being in the hospital on the operating table and noticing how my mouth is filled with blood, and I'm in and out of consciousness, and I hear people talking, and I ask them if they would please get a priest for me because I am dying. And some man's voice says, no, we're doing all we can to keep that from happening. And then all of a sudden I hear a man's voice saying that you've asked for a priest. And they said, yes. And he said, I would like to hear your confession. Would you like to do that? And it threw me because, no, I wasn't looking for a confession. I was looking for a priest to give me the last rites. And he said, okay, let's go from there. And then all of a sudden, the pain was subsiding that I was feeling all over. And it just got quieter, and the voices got quieter. And suddenly I was in no more pain.
Right.
And then the next thing I remembered was the next day. And I think it was the next day. And somebody was touching my head. And I'm saying, oh, you know, I hurt. And she said, I said, these bandages, something is on me. And she said, yes. She said, they're compression bandages. She said, there are parts of your scalp that are missing. And she said that we have to put pressure on them. And she said, you'll be all right. You'll be okay. God is with you. You are a miracle.
Right.
And
you also,
so then, go ahead.
So you then reminisce. You are settled and you realize where you are. You have people. You are safe. Your friends come to visit. There are people around you. You realize that you are okay. Then you realize, as you do in the book, you reminisce about how this all started, your marriage with Bob, before your children arrived. And as you do, you tell us about who you were before you met Bob and you grew up. So tell our audience how you met Bob, but before that, how you grew up, where you grew up.
I grew up in a Polish neighborhood in Chicago. They were all like little neighborhoods, and I went to both at the Art Institute for a while, and also the Chicago Academy of Fine Arts is where I got my degree in fashion design, and I worked part-time at Marshall Fields, and I went to school over there, you know, at downtown Chicago. I was very happy I got the top job in offer, and it was to design for Maidenform. And you would
right.
think that is not, but that was the highest paid job then, and it was just my last day at school when Mary came and started talking about this. But we had a big Polish wedding. It was supposed to just be a nice little formal wedding, and then Bob's parents said, you know, we've been going to weddings all of our years, and we would like all more people. And before you knew it, our wedding that we were planning was totally out of control, and it was our parents' wedding. And I made the dresses and the, you know, my dress, all of the bridesmaids' dresses. And then Rich's cousins, and that was helping me with some of the stuff. But anyhow, Bob wanted to finish more schooling, And so we ended up in Houston, Texas, for one of the most prestigious photography studios in the world, and I got that job as a receptionist just because before that we lived in Bloomington, as he finished the year before. And I worked at a studio, and they suggested I go there, and that was one of the great experiences of my life. They were associated with the Bach Rock Studio, and our clients were the president and the royalty of the world. And from that, we came to the Midwest, back here for him to get his job. And then I had, we decided to settle down here for a couple years with the promise that we would go back to Chicago and I could continue my career. But in those days, a lot of us women, we bent to our husband, to their career, and so I put mine on the back stage so that we could further his. And we bought a home, a student home, a student house for college students to live in. So I had 17 students that I had to take care of, plus working my job, and he worked his job. And I got pregnant and had a miscarriage, and was told, had to have major surgery, and was told that I would never be able to have children. There was just too much damage. And so we adopted a beautiful little baby girl. And then, lo and behold, I got pregnant. And the doctor said there was no way. There was too much missing. And yet, there it was. I had three children. And in the meantime, we bought a pet, St. Bernard. And then we took her to obedience school and found out she was pretty good, so they said, show her. So we showed her, and before you knew it, we were showing this dog and getting interested in the breeding program and showing. And Rich's career, or his first name is Bob, middle name, but we called him that. So Bob's career had taken off. And we were doing well, and we decided to build a kennel to board and groom dogs. And it was so beautifully done that Ralston Purina came out, took pictures. It was in the newspapers and everything. So now I was the head of that while he was working his job. And we had people helping with the house and the children. And life seemed very, very good, and we were very happy.
You talk
and
about
then,
your... You were talking about your career aspirations, though, that you eventually wanted to go back to Chicago.
My career aspirations were put on the back burner.
Right, but your plans always were to head to Chicago, but all these plans were on the back burner. But let me ask you about your relationship. We haven't talked about, I mean, obviously you fell in love. It was you thought it was an idyllic marriage. You had goals. He loved the idea of adopting when you realized that you might not be able to, well, you were told you wouldn't be able to have children. When you did have children, he was excited. He was a good father. He was a participant. Your marriage was strong, so you thought. These are the kinds of things in his personality that you loved about him. And at some point during this time, things changed. But it took a long time for you to see any changes in him whatsoever. He was a happy person. You said at some point before you
noticed anything untoward. You noticed a difference in his behavior, just towards you.
He was such a jovial person. He loved everybody, and everybody loved him. And I never would think that he would not just be the perfect husband as he had been. I mean, wonderful father. Oh my gosh, life was good. The kennel was growing, and everything was beautiful. I mean, it was just like a dream. You know, we couldn't have children, and then we did. And this one day, and he started a new business for someone doing his type of work, and we had decided to go on a vacation to. No, it was before we went on the vacation. We were invited to one of his nurses' homes for dinner. And I said, and we had a wonderful time, and the children were with him, and they had three children. And I said to him, as we got in the car, I said, "Gee, I said, I can't believe how she could have, you know, the house that neat with three children working, and." It was just overwhelming that she could do all that. And he said, sometimes the house isn't that clean. And suddenly, something was wrong. And I said, you've been here before? And he stuttered and said, well, a couple times her husband couldn't get there to the clinic to pick her up, so I drove her home. And we're in the car, and he's starting it, and it was autumn, and the little tiny leaves were dancing across the hood of the car as he started it, and I started shaking. See, I felt like something is different in our life now that was never there before. And that's when I first picked up on something I had hoped that that wasn't real. But it was the beginning of the end in a way.
You talked about that when you grew up, your parents seemed to always fight. And then you thought that Bob's parents had a good relationship. And so you did get close to these people and counted on them for help with the children, obviously, and everything that ever happened to you, including the accident and all the hospitalizations, these people were there for you.
Always. And I was there for them to the day they died.
Mm-hmm.
We had an excellent, excellent family relationship. And so, but things started going wrong. There was just that feeling when we went to Florida. He's sending little cards to the old nurse that worked with him, not to this one that I was concerned about. And I said, "You're sending cards?" Because he never would send, you know, a card to anybody. And it was just another thing that started me worrying about what was going on. And then one day, I had to go to the kennel to get it opened, waiting for the receptionist to come in. I came back to the house and bumped into him, and he should have already left for the hospital. And I said, and he's standing there holding sleeping bags that came from the girl's closet. And I said, what are you doing? And he said, oh, I noticed these needed repairing. And I said, they need repairing? And I said, they don't need repairing. What are you doing in their closet? He said that I just looked at it, something was sticking out of the shelf, and I walked by and I picked him up and I was going to show it to you, and thought that there was something wrong. So I, at that point, was thinking, no, he's taking them out somewhere for the afternoon, for the lunch, to go to the park or something like that. And that was my first thing. Then there were other instances where I knew that he was going out at night and sneaking in. And realized that there was something going on, and I had to go to the university with a puppy and leave my youngest son with one of my friends who had a child that age. And when I left him, I was shaking all over. That was the day, he was had the blankets. And she said, "What's the matter?" And I said, "Nothing." And she said, "Yes, there is something." And she said, "You need to sit down and listen to what I have to say." And she said that all of us in the kennel club are getting these strange phone calls. And they are just saying how nervous you are and this. And she said, "We all know you better than that." And she said, "Everyone's talking, but nobody's telling you." She said, "Nancy," she said, "I think there's something going on." And I said, "I do too." And I said, "I don't know what to do." And I said, she says, "Why don't you prove it so that one way or another?" And I said, "Well, how do I do that?" And she said, "Hire a detective." I said, "I can't afford a detective. The kennel is just hanging on a thread. It's new." And so anyhow, I went to the University of Illinois to have the puppy checked, and came back home and picked up my child and went to the kennel and opened the phone book, and there was enough money. I opened, because the Christmas boarders were checking out, and I called a detective and I told him my suspicions of the different things that were happening. And he said, "Piece of cake." And I said, "Well, what are you talking about?" He said, I'll have him disproven for you in a day or two." I said, "You're kidding." He said, "No." He said, "He's gotten so cocky now that it will be easy." And so I paid him the money, and he put a trap on the car or under the wheels or what they do, and they followed him to the park with different sleeping bags. And so it was just such a relief, because I had been thinking I'm going crazy, that this cannot be happening. He is just the best person in the whole world, you know, and you're doubting yourself. I'm doubting me, you know, like, what's going on here with, you know, we have everything going for us. But I guess it looked pretty good to somebody else, too. And that night, he was going to bowling with the group. And the detective called me from the bowling alley.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+ terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered ChumbaCasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+ terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
And he said, "Did he just call you?" And I said, "No." And he said, "What'd he say?" because he was standing in line behind him waiting for the phone. And he told me that he was going to drive somebody home. And he said, okay, I'll follow you, him. And when he followed him to her house. And then an hour later, he called me and said he's leaving, and he had a flat tire. And right. So there was middle of nothing. And so he had to call me to tell me to pick him up. And it was rather joyous, you know, in a way, because I knew that I wasn't crazy, because that was really starting to, you know, work on me, that I'm imagining that this great guy could do this. So anyhow, I filed for divorce, and he said, no, let's go for counseling, let's go for counseling, let's go to this priest, let's go to a priest, he won't charge us. So we go to the priest, and we both talk to him, and then he said, I want to talk to each of you for 1 hour. And then he said, I'll let you know whether I can counsel you, and I will call you, Nancy. And he never called, so a couple days went by, and I called him, and he said, I've decided I can't counsel you. His problems are too deep. I said, what are you talking about, his problems? He's having a fling. What kind of problems does he have? And he says, my suggestion is you go to see a psychiatrist, and you both have to go if you want to save this marriage. He said, but my honest feelings are, get the divorce. Don't go. But I know I'm not going to give up. So I went to the psychiatrist 2 times, and he refused to go. And then one of my friends says that, she says, why don't we try my reverend? He's a Presbyterian, and he was the head pastor at one of the big prisons in the United States. She said, you can tell him anything, and so can your husband, Bob. And I said, okay, and we went to him for counseling, and for months it was very nice. Everything was like back to normal. And then all of a sudden something is wrong. Just something is wrong that I can't put my fingers on. And I didn't know what to do, and I went back to the reverend. And he said, Nancy, he said, I've never known a woman to say that. She knows you're built in with special equipment in your brains when you know something is wrong, and it is then wrong. She said, now you must get out of this. You must get out of this marriage. It is not healthy. And he said, it's a man's world. You know, you got to get everything you can, but you got to get out of this now. And I'm still not, you know, just, I'm not ready to let go. But in the meantime, this story goes along of my being in the hospital. And all of the, each day, something new. I'm in the hospital 16 days, and ironically, we had been married 16 years. And each day I find a different thing. First couple days, just that I'm alive. And then how much damage. I think the third or fourth day, the 3 doctors come in. One's in a suit, two are in their garb. And they said, hey, you're looking pretty good, lady. And I'm, of course, looking at them. I have no idea who they are. And they are introducing themselves. And, of course, I can barely see. And I still don't know. And they're just saying, look, let's check you out and see how you're doing. And they're looking at my head. And they said, look at that. He said, we did a good job. He said, those ears made it. I said, what ears made it? They said, well, your ears were cut off except for the facial tissue. holding him on. And we did our best under the circumstances, you know, that to hope that we could get them to stay on. I said, I might not have ears, and with that, I don't remember anything else that they said. I was just in such a state of shock that I think I fainted away. And right. Each day, different doctors would come in and check me for different things on my head and telling me where I stood. I had no idea what I looked like. I know that a plastic surgeon came in and he picked me up and put me on the windowsill to take a good look. And he said, wow. He said, you know, this is amazing. Your face is cracked completely in half on this side, the whole face, and the other one just partly. He said, but it, according to the x-rays, it looks like it's going back together, which I just can't believe, without having to get in there and pin it. He said, you're going to have some scars. You're going to need a lot of scars. You have a lot of scars. We're going to have to remove your scalp at the top and pull it up over a little bit to hide. There's so many up at the top there. And I'm just listening and thinking, oh, my God, what do I look like? I must be a monster because of these things. And I don't want, I'm not looking at myself. I had asked the nurse the day before to turn the mirror that was way up in front on the wall around. I was afraid to look at me because I'd already heard about the ears. And now I'm hearing about this, and each day it was something else. An eye doctor was there all the time, and then they had a dentist come in on another day, and this just went on and on and on.
500 stitches in your face and your head, you write.
Pardon? How many?
500 stitches.
Oh, yes. More than, they said they lost track on the operating table. That's when they lost me. That's when I died. That's when the priest was there. I died when the priest was there. They were counting. They just couldn't believe there was so much damage. And they had got to that. And then of course, that went, then it was the time to save my life and stop counting stitches.
Mm-hmm.
And
you're in the hospital recovering, and every day you chronicle that in the book and talk about things getting better, but also that you also learn things as time goes on. Of course, at first, because of Bob, and we haven't got to what exactly happened, but because of this, you're not even having phone contact with anybody, and there's a guard outside the hospital in case. When you're in the hospital as well, you talk to somebody, and it's a very important phone call with Sue's husband, Chuck. What does he say to you?
Yes, and that was later. That was a little bit later when I was already thinking that maybe because the attorneys wouldn't take him as a client unless he committed himself. You know, he had been arrested and he had enough money from the kennel to bail himself out, but he had to commit himself to the mental ward before they would take him as a client. And he did, and the police gave him a truth serum drug to have him tell the truth, and he hyperventilated. He knows enough about medicine that if you do that, they won't do it again, and they chose not to do it again, so they got no information out of him. And they did run medical tests and find out that he had hypoglycemia and sort of the opposite of sugar diabetes, but and they sometimes can make people do strange things, but this was more than strange. And then he was able to be free, and like every day I learned something new about what was happening to me, what condition I was in, what things I was going to have done when I got out of the hospital. I hadn't talked to my children, and at one point I thought about that. I thought, oh my God, I haven't even thought about the kids. Where's my head? You know, I mean, is everybody okay? And that, I mean, I was just still so out of it for such a long time. And there was a point that came to nearing the end, and I was thinking maybe, you know, going for help, that I needed to think about this, that he is sick, he's got a problem, and maybe I should rethink this. And the phone rang, and it was her ex-husband. She divorced him in the year and a half that we were separated, you know, that we weren't separated, but that we were having this problem. I'm still married, but he divorced her. And he said, does anyone, he said, I know that you're thinking of going back. And he said, you need to hear this before you do. He said, oh, not even a year ago, the phone rang and I was on a different shift. And he said, I heard them talking. And I thought I was sleeping. He said, I paid little attention until now. And he said, what I heard was, he said, did you have any kind of surgery? And I said, yes, I had some vein stripping. And I said, I had a really rough time, all of the incisions infected. He said, and I said, and as a matter of fact, you're what, and I'm accusing them still of having an affair. And she calls me and asks me to drive me to the doctor for my checkup.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was so strange. But it was later in the same day that I fainted at the kennel. I was at the kennel, and I'm getting ready to go to the doctor to have him check my incisions. And I'm at the kennel just checking everything is okay, everybody's there that's supposed to be there, and I'm going to go, and I fainted. And I called my husband, Bob, and I told him. And he said, don't go driving. I said, why not? I said, this doesn't make, you know, I said, I'm okay now. I said, I just probably turned my head too fast or something. And then his girlfriend-to-be calls me and asks to drive me. And he said, it was such a weird conversation that I never mentioned it to you. He said, but today something happened and that made me go back to this weird conversation. And he said, and this was when I was getting close to leaving the hospital, 14th day or something like that. And he said, does anybody sell a certain brand of dog food? And I said, no, nobody in the country has it. One of the breweries is starting to make it, and they didn't give us. We bought 4 tons of it to have it.
Mm. Right.
And he said, well, I thought that you and your husband are thinking about getting back together, and I just wanted you to know there were 10 bags of it on our porch because they had one of our dogs. They bought one from us. Mm-hmm. And he said, and that conversation that I heard last year or close to it came back to me, you know, that I should tell you no matter how bizarre it is, because if there's nothing going on and he wants to get back to you, why does she have this dog food? He said, you know, I've been so naive all of this time, Nancy, that Nina, you know, that you need to know, you need to know that that this may still be going on. And so right then and there, I decided, okay, that was it. That was it. But even before that happened, I was getting to that point. There was another point that I, besides going to Reverend Gates, I went back to call the priest to see, if he would consider. I was trying everything desperately to keep my family together, foolishly. And I called the priest, and the housekeeper answered and then said, "Father's in the hospital. He's having minor surgery, and he's such a sissy about it." She said, "I'm going to call him and tell him you're going to go because we've talked about you over the last year, and he'll be glad to see you." And so I went up to see him at the hospital. And he said, these are just, all of these things are scattered, but they're in the book, and then they piece together beautifully. I'm not doing a good job of it. And I went to see him, and he said, "I'm so glad you're here." And I said, "I'm so glad you're going to counsel us." And he said, "Oh, no, I'm not going to counsel you." He said, "I've thought about this and thought about us. And remember when I suggested you go to a psychiatrist?" He said, "I could see something that, of danger, and how could I tell you? I'm a psychologist, but I just knew the problems were so deep within this person." And he said, "I want you to leave, Nina. I want you to leave right now and go file and get out of this marriage while you still can." And I was shaking so bad, and I had to go to that dark parking deck to get my car. And I was shaking, and I couldn't get the damn key into the lock of the car. And I finally got it, and I jumped into the car, and I put my head on the steering wheel and just sat there for a little bit to try to get my composure before I start driving. And there was a bang on the car door, and I looked and screamed, and the person was an elderly man, and he screamed, and he just happened to be in the car next to me, and he thought I was sick. And I said, no, I'm okay." And I said, "I'm okay, I'm just thinking." And I hurried up and got out of there, and over all the years to this day, I worry about that man. I worry, "Oh, my God, I could have killed him. I hope I didn't." He was so terrified, and I was so terrified. And then right after that is when all of this stuff happened. And the book is written where it goes very smoothly, a day in the hospital and a day of our life, and the reviews have been just wonderful, saying how well written it is, and I'm so proud of it. So much better than my talking on the podcast. I'm sorry.
I wanted to go back a little bit, because again, we haven't talked about this actual what he actually did and why. We talk about when you mentioned you're in the hospital recovering, and you talk to Chuck. He also told you, you had to get out, that the suspicions you had were true, but he gave you some startling information about this car accident you were involved with your husband and your children, where you were almost killed, and the idea of the antibiotic that you were prescribed when you had the varicose vein incisions and operation when it became infected.
That was part of the conversation. Is that, some of what you're saying is a little bit out of order. So on the conversation, he said, "Were you taking any pills?" I said, "Yes, I was going to the doctor to check my legs for the surgery." This was, months and months before the actual murder. And her husband asked me, Chuck said, "Were you taking medicine?" And I said, yes, I was taking an antibiotic and a muscle relaxant. And he said, and did anything happen? And I said, yes, I fainted. But I thought it was just because I had turned around too quickly or so when I went to the kennel to check to make sure everything was okay. And I was going to the doctor to have him check my legs. And he said they about taking medicine out of a capsule and putting sleeping medicine in it. And I said, oh, my God, that's what happened. Because when I went to the doctor, he said he had never seen all of those incisions infect. He said, once in a while you'll get one. You know, that you'll have one incision, but a whole row of them, all infected. Were you taking your antibiotics? And I said, yes. And then that led me to what Chuck had said, is that, oh, my God, they had taken my antibiotic medicine out of the capsules and poured sleeping medicine, and that's why I collapsed on the floor. And I could have gotten into a car accident, and I did go ahead and drive, and I didn't notice anything else. But I could have killed people. I could have killed me. But they wanted me to sleep so that they could get out at night, and that they didn't know that during the day I had an appointment to go to the doctor, and that. Now, I didn't know, do you want me to tell the actual event of
happened? We need to hear this, because as you write in the book, all along this time that you're in the recovery, after the phone restrictions are lifted, Bob calls and Bob expresses his love and his commitment to the family, and then tells you about this hypoglycemia that he's suffering from, and that if he just gets medication, he'd be back to normal, and he professes his love, and that he's just sick. But let's go back to when you were separated, and then what happens in this actual attack? What leads up to this? Tell us about that.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At chumbacasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions 18 plus.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun, Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from, with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere, and each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
To the attack. We were doing better. We seemed to be doing better, and yet he was very strange. It was just like there was a coldness there that had never been, nothing mean or anything, and I didn't notice him going, no more escaping at night or any of those things, and he said that she was dating some policeman, and so I figured she's out of the radar. And we had plans to go to a friend's house about 20 miles away to play cards and go out to dinner. And it was a blizzard. It was a horrible blizzard. And I said, we can't go. So I called, my groomer said, you got to be crazy. She said, I'm getting out of here now as soon as I'm done with these dogs. And she said, you got to be nuts. You better call. And I called him, and I said, Bob, I said, we're not going. That's it. Call them, and we're not going anywhere. I said, it's the snows already, and it ended up being one of Peoria's worst blizzards ever. And I said, we're just going to stay right here. And he said, no, we're not. We're going. And I said, you got to be kidding. He said, we've canceled three times or twice or whatever it was on them. And I said, so what? They're going to understand they wouldn't come here. Why would we go there? And right. He said, we are going. So I said, all right, you're driving. And I thought that we would be taking the smaller car that he used. Not we had a big 12 passenger van because we were hauling St. Bernards and that to dog shows. And we go, and Lucy, the nurse that had been babysitting for us, there are other incidents that have happened that were very powerful in the book that you won't hear till you read the book. Anyhow, Lucy was here. And I said, Lucy, this is crazy. And I said, you know, we should not be going. And I said, this is dangerous. This is very dangerous. And I said, for some reason, he sure wants to get me out tonight. And so she just laughed, and he said, I'll drive you home tonight, Lucy, because it'll be too bad for you to go home. And I thought, too bad? I said, I don't even know how she got here. She's an old woman, has a little old car, and drives like, 30 miles an hour. And so we go. We get we're taking the van. I said, why on earth are we taking the big van? The little car holds the road a lot better than this big thing is going to, he said, we're going to take the van. I said, okay, you're driving, and so we went to dinner, and we got done with dinner with our friends, and they're getting ready to go home, and Bob says, no, we're going to play cards. They said, you've got to be kidding. It's like 6 inches deep already. We don't need to play cards. And my husband says, yes, we do. We planned this and planned this. And he said, the road, there's nobody much on the road, and we're not going to have any problems. And it's just so bizarre that we're going to do this. And so we play cards for an hour, and then we're getting into the car, and he said, you drive. I said, me? I never drive this thing, especially in this kind of weather. Why would you want me to drive? And he said, I've got a headache, and I'm going to go lay down on the back seat. And it was a 12-passenger van, so there were several rows of seats. And I said, you better sit right behind me because I don't even know where the edge of the road is. I don't even see a car. We're on a small interstate. I mean, on a small state road. And I said, I don't even see a car. I'm not even sure where the edge of the road is. And he said, I'll guide you. So anyhow, he's guiding me, and we've driven just about 15 minutes. And he said, I'm going to lay down. I said, you got to be kidding. You can't go lay down. You can't go lay down. I said, I cannot see anything. And he said, okay, pull over there. There's an animal clinic that we have gone to. And there's a big wide mouth to the driveway. You can just pull over. And I said, why don't you just put your head out the window and vomit? Because he said he had to vomit. And I said, because this is crazy. It is crazy. We can't pull off. We're not sure we're on. And he said, we're on it. Now put the car in park. I said, what the hell? Why am I putting the car in park? He said, put the car in park. And it won't slide. I said, where's it going to slide? We're on that flat space. And he's adamant about my putting the car in park. And I do that. I put it in park. Should I tell the rest?
Yes.
Okay. And anyhow, I put the car in park. And all of a sudden, I feel something hit my head, and I thought a car may have run into us. And I look over my shoulder, and he's there, and he has this big mechanical tool, some kind of a tool, I don't know what it is, and he hit me again. And I'm screaming, what are you doing? What are you doing? I love you. I love you. Why are you, what are you doing to me? And he doesn't say a word. He just looks cold and icy and makes no comments. And he just keeps hitting me. And at one point, I could feel it slide across the front of me. And I grabbed it with my arm and held it. And held it, and it's a great big tool of some kind, heavy. And he jumps over the top of me, facing me, and he hits me with his fist on my face. And I notice he's wearing my new leather gloves I gave him for Christmas. And he hits me again and again, and I'm begging and begging, and I'm saying, you can't do that, and I'm praying to my mom, Mom, please watch over me, because you warned me. You warned me years ago that he could be dangerous, and I thought you just drank too much that night, and I passed it off, and I feel her there now helping me, trying to say the right thing, and I said, stop. And at one point, he hits this vein on my head, and the blood squirts on this huge windshield, and it goes from one side to the other like a rainbow, and it just dripping down. And I said, please stop. We'll say we got in an accident. And he stops. And I said, we'll say that we skidded off the road and you went to the farmhouse over there to get help. And a car hit us. And that's how I got so hurt. Then he says, okay, because I think he just had it. I don't know. And so he climbs over me. He helps move me to the passenger seat. And I still got this tool, whatever it is, under my arm. And he didn't pay any attention to it. He just moved me over. And I said, please get me to the emergency room. I'm dying. And he said, you're not dying. I said, please get me there. So he had me rehearsed on the way there to the hospital. He's actually taking me to the hospital. And I've still got the tool. And he said, throw that out of the window. So I opened the window, and instead I just let it slip right down the side of me and held on to it, thinking, you know, if nothing else, I'll fall out of the car. I'll open the car and fall out. You know, and we pull up, actually. And, you know, I'm still thinking, there's no way we're gonna go. That he's not going to take me there, but he's taking me there. And so I said, I can't talk anymore. My mouth hurts so much. I know what I'm going to say. And then, of course, when you pulled up to the emergency room, the policeman comes, and then he sees me, and he starts screaming to people to get, you know, the stretcher and that kind of thing. And then he goes around, and he's talking to my husband, and I have no idea what he's saying to him. And then the person opens the door and gets me ready, and I'm holding on to this thing in my arm, and he said, whoa. He said, that's the biggest commercial pipe wrench I've ever seen. So that's what it was. It was a commercial that he had probably taken from the hospital, the clinic, whatever. Wow. And then, you know, I go... they take me into the thing, and I'm still able to give my parents' names and numbers and that kind of thing, and tell them just to tell the children we were in a car accident, but we're okay. And then I remember them cutting my clothes off. They're, you know, and the lady said, "Oh my goodness, this is your bra is so beautiful." And I said, "Yeah, it's brand new. He just bought it for me. He bought me all. He never buys me anything, and he bought me a brand new coat with the fur collar and my suit and everything." And I was dressed in all of that, and they're cutting it off and apologizing. And I'm getting sick, and they said, "She's hurry up, get a pan. She's going to vomit." So then I'm starting to vomit, and then I lose it a little bit until I get into the operating room. And when I get there, I'm not even sure I'm there. I just know that my mouth is so full of blood, and that's when it goes on to my asking for a priest, and that's when I die on the operating table. And I did not know that I died on the operating table for many days. And the only reason I found that out was by accident. One of our friends is a doctor, and a lot of them were. And he, it was, you know, like 9 o'clock at night. He had come to see me, and I could see him then. It was like, I don't know, 8 days, somewhere around there. And he is drunk. And he's got a tuxedo on, and his tie is crooked. And he said, "Hi, babe." And he said, "I just didn't have the nerve to come and see you." And so he's sitting with me, holding my hand. And in comes somebody else, and he said, "Hi, you don't recognize me?" And I said, "No." He said, "I'm the anesthesiologist," and he said, "Mac," he said, "there's no reason for this gal to be here." He said, "It's the second time in my career I had to go home." He said, "And I've been at this a long time, you know that, Mac." And he said, "We're operating on her, and she's telling us Polish jokes." And he says, yeah. And then she goes unconscious, and then she comes back and tells us another Polish joke because she's Polish, and she hears all of the jokes. And he said, "We're just looking at each other, and we're trying to piece what we can, you know, back." And he said, "I lost her." He said, "I lost her, Mac." And he said, "I want you to know, and Mac, you remember to remind her that her blood pressure," and he said, "years will pass by and different things will happen, but you remember this, because in all my life this never happened." He said, "When that blood pressure dropped, it dropped, it went out." And he said, "We had a hard time getting it back. It didn't went from normal." And he said, "We couldn't believe it staying at normal." And he said, "And then it was gone." And he said, "I want you to know that, so that when you have other surgeries or anything in your life, you will be able to tell them that this is something they need to look out for." And so I remembered that, and that's how I found out that I died on the operating table. And true, what he said, 3 different times that happened to me after I had anesthesia. So he knew that no matter how much, if all the new technology and that, it was still, you know, it happened 3 times. And two minor surgeries and 1 major, my blood pressure dropped drastically low but came right back up. That's the thing. And they never had to do anything, although one time they did get the crash cart. But it just went back up like it never happened.
You talk about that you reached out to...
Pardon?
You talk about you reached out to Lucy when you were being attacked. Or not reached out to Lucy, but you mentioned, referenced Lucy.
You said to him, Lucy's his nurse aide.
She was our babysitter. Our babysitter and my husband's old reception nurse. When he moved from one hospital to another, he loved her. She was very old. She couldn't get another job, so he had them hire her as part of them hiring him.
When you were attacked, you mentioned her name. You referenced her name and said, listen, Lucy knows about this murder plot. Lucy knows. You didn't. You just said that to him, but you kept talking about Lucy.
I had touched base with Lucy a couple times on the phone saying, Lucy, you know what's going on, don't you, over there with him? And, you know, and this woman, and she said, I can't say anything. But there was another incident that happened. There were several things, but Lucy knew that this affair was going on. And there was another incident. Do I have time?
Well, all I wanted you to tell, the incident is fine, but what I wanted to mention was that it seemed to be, in this, from reading this, is that your references to Lucy knowing about this may have prevented him from doing more damage to you.
Yes.
Because he did respect this woman, and you said, listen, Lucy knows what you're doing to plan to kill me. And he said, no, she doesn't. She doesn't know any of this. So I think it was one of the more vivid moments in this attack that somehow or other that respect for that woman, and you knew that instinctively, that you just said that to him, was a dramatic part of this attack.
I mentioned it before too at other things, you know, Lucy knows, and she would just, you know, like always say, what can I say? Her job is hanging, you know, there. But maybe that's why he stopped, because it had gone too far. And I don't know. And Lucy would have to say what my suspicions were all along, that.
Yes. What you have in this book is as well, that I mentioned, that while you're recovering, Bob calls you, and Bob says, listen, I have this hypoglycemia. Again, this disease, he called it, this thing that he just found out he had, apparently this caused him to kill you, try to kill you, want to kill you, attempt to kill you. Now, this is his lawyer, says he won't take the case unless he goes to psychiatric evaluation, and within a short period of time, 10 days, he's out, he gets to visit with your children while you're still in the hospital.
Yes.
So what happens from this? You finally talk to Chuck. People finally, because even when you're being attacked, you're saying, you're sick, I'm going to cover for you. So it's incredible that you still care for this person and trust this person, unbelievably. Now that you have this realization when you're in the hospital, that's enough, I've heard enough, I cannot love this person enough to continue with him. But he has this defense for this horrendous attack on you. What happens from those charges, from that investigation, from what the police know has been done to you, what happens as a result?
The attorneys got together, and they talked to the psychiatrist, the head of psychiatry, and that, and he felt that I am no longer in any danger, that it's over, he's lost. He did this because not he hated me, but because he wanted to keep the kennel and the kids and all of that. He wanted to have all of that. He didn't want to lose this kennel that we designed, and that meant more to him than anything, and he was, you know, he was going to lose it. And the attorneys said, for once, you know, let us think about this Nina and what she's going to face. with four children. We have he's, no matter what kind of disease he has, we have grounds to put him in jail. Now, what are we doing for the kids? If we do this, they're going to have a father in jail and no income. And what does it say for them, for their life? You know, where is their father? What does he do? He's in jail. He's lost the things that he really wants. Now let's see if we can. We owned a couple apartment houses that we had just purchased that were highly in debt because we just got them. And that he said, let's see if this excuse, the hypoglycemia, Nancy. Nina, Nancy, Nina, and her friend Nancy that she talked to, that said, you know, what do we have? What should we do? What do you think? And so the attorneys got together, and they said, you've got to go to the grand jury, and you tell what you know. You never lie. Had he ever done this before? No, is the answer. And if they go further than that, you have to answer honestly. If that's as far as they go, we're trying to work out a deal with Bob. And the two of us are trying to look out for you, that we will say that this happened because of this. He will continue to work and keep his license as a therapist. And he will give child support to you. If we put him in jail, we can put him in there for a long time because we can pull out some other things and that. But looking after you, he can have her if he wants her, you know. But this is the gamble that you take, that we're all taking. And so I had to go to the grand jury. And I did not lie. That's the only question they asked me. Had he ever done anything like that before? No. So that, then he will not lose his license for attempted murder or murder. And, the children will get child support. I will get all the properties. And that's what happened. He got married a month after we got divorced to her. He slept on the sofa for 7 of the 10 years, I think, that they were married. He passed away some time ago.
So
what am I leaving out?
Pardon? This is a very interesting in this arrangement that you have, because it's unique in terms of...
That would never happen nowadays.
Why do you say that?
Well, just because I think, you know, they would just immediately, you know, go for the thing. They wouldn't be out, the attorneys protecting
mm-hmm.
a person that was so wounded and everything, trying to make sure that she had a way to support her family,
right,
and taking
right.
the risk that he's loose.
Yeah.
And do you think I wasn't frightened for 2 years? For two
Certainly.
Years, if anyone touched me when I was at the kennel or a noise or anything happened, I would faint.
Yes.
I would just faint and pee. Embarrassing, but it would happen, and my groomer was constantly getting me up and walking me to our home, which was close by.
You write about this decision that the court talked you into. In retrospect, you would have a different. If it were today, you say it would be different. Nothing.
I don't know.
Would be the same.
I don't know that anybody would do that at all. This is what people tell me. You know, I mean, the court. Mm-hmm. No, the court did their job, and I did mine. I answered honestly. They told me if they asked more, then I would have to give them the rest of the, and then this deal could not work.
Was this a
deal?
The deal would not work.
They would, you know, he would be, you know, put in jail and tried.
Of course. Is this a deal you were totally comfortable with, though? You don't really, I mean, how comfortable were you with this? Of course you get the explanation. But at some point you realize he tried to kill you. And then you write
the psychiatrist that said,
okay, he's hypoglycemic.
Yeah,
and then
he never
just
knew
has medication.
The other attempts that Bob had made on me. The psychiatrist
right.
didn't. And I didn't mm-hmm. know that, you know, until we start getting into it with the attorneys and everything, that the psychiatrist didn't know the other attempts, and they really weren't attempt. Like there was a lake incident and that, and we never talked about that, but nothing mm-hmm. came of it. And that he had made other attempts, but nothing came of it. Had that been brought out, then.
Well, those are ones that police might say, well, they're interesting, but you could have never brought up that, I believe, in court as proof of anything.
That's
regardless
right.
of whether you... But at the same time, though, the thing that would have been much different, and many years ago even, would have been this obvious motive. He gets married to this woman. He maintains his relationship with this woman. You know, this woman and this man would not be the first man that a prosecutor would put out the motive possible that this person wanted to get rid of his wife, avoid a divorce, and carry on with his new life. That's, I think, what a prosecutor would seriously contemplate in this case, given all the information, don't you think?
I don't know. This is the way it worked. And I lived in fear for a long time. You know, it was what they thought was the most practical thing to keep a family alive. That.
And you've
Pardon?
Obviously thrived. You've obviously thrived from this point.
No, we didn't. No, we didn't thrive. I had to sell everything. I was single for 21 years. I worked at one point for 4.5 years. I worked 70 hours a week. A week.
Mm-hmm.
Until I went into shock. Everything was highly mortgaged. Nothing had any kind of value to it. But they got child support, and he lied about mm-hmm. that. My accounting firm discovered it, and he came up with a few thousand dollars. So I did not thrive. I did not thrive. My children say the real book is the next one, Mom. When I was doing dog grooming, dressmaking, working at a factory for Alcoa, and cleaning house for my best friend, and nobody knew it. Nobody was told. We'd be sitting playing cards with my girlfriends and her, and she'd say, "Oh, you have a new housekeeper?" And she would just say yes, and that went on for 5 years. I cleaned her house, and nobody knew it, and then I came back that day and played cards with them. I had it really rough, and you can ask any of my children. that it was really difficult, and yet they were raised with it's going to be grade school, high school, college. That's it. And everybody got through, and everybody had loans.
So you did it. It didn't crush you.
Pardon?
This didn't crush you.
It didn't crush me. It was difficult. It was more than difficult. It was scary. And the only thing that still stays with me is I get frightened if something happens behind me. But I don't wet my pants anymore. But that happened for almost 2 years.
Yes. So. You recovered your life enough to write this book. I know this is a cliche question, but how important was it for you to complete this book, to write this book, and now have this book finally released?
I wrote it 30 years ago, and I never changed it. The order of it, we just changed the wording here and there to make it more legible. It was important to me that I survived it. And I look at what I accomplished and I see four wonderful human beings that I got to raise.
What is their attitude towards this? I know that they were protected. You say the boys were younger than the girls. The boys didn't have any idea, and the girls knew a little bit more. Of course, you tried to keep everything as an accident and tried to protect them from this terrible event, but obviously they grew up. Obviously they watched the news. Even the girls saw the news.
Yes. And the boys...
They did see their father. What is their attitude?
Of course, it was on the paper, it was on television, it was on everything. And the girls, one was just 11, 11, 9, let's see, no, 5, 7, 9, 11. The oldest girl knows. They all knew. The boys knew something, but they're babies. Right. But over the years, there's no hiding it. There is no hiding what happened. And little by little, of course, I had to sell off the properties, and that was managed to keep this. And in the summertime, when the children got good jobs at a factory to help, with their schooling and everything. They even gave me money to make sure I didn't lose the house. I lost everything else. I didn't lose it. I sold it, but didn't make any money. Everything was heavily mortgaged.
Yes.
And now, the boys have still, one of them, was with his dad not long before he passed away. He was already an adult and out of school, college. And do they love him? The boys, I think, still love him. One likes him but doesn't love him. The other one, the older boy, loves his dad, got to watch some football games with him and that. One went and spent a summer with him, and it came home early. The girls have nothing for him or have very little love for him. I still love part of him and think, how could you do this still? How could you do this? How could you do this to me? I still question it and still wonder at times, what could I have done? What could I have done to change the scenario?
What about the hypoglycemia for people listening, I mean,
I have
there
no
are novels
idea. It's a sugar imbalance or something like that, but it's supposed to be the opposite of sugar diabetes.
But you were convinced that this was serious enough to mitigate the idea that he murdered you intentionally, that somehow he was sick, it's a disease, and that the disease actually created this, despite what you know about the affair, despite you know about the difference in his behavior. I know you were convinced of that, but how convinced are you that it was the disease and not just a change in this person? I know it's something hard to contemplate.
No, I knew he did it purposely, and I just think it got to be too much. And he woke up like and said he can't go any further the day he did that.
In what way he couldn't go any further? You mean,
I mean
just your prodding?
He couldn't keep beating me. I don't know why. I don't know why. I don't have that answer. Why he didn't just finish the job right there. Maybe because of what I'm yelling at him and that. Maybe he just realized...
It's incredible the love you had for this man, though. It's so admirable how much you would stand behind this person after all of this, and even pick up the phone and listen to this person when you were sitting near death in a hospital or just recovered from near death experience. It's, I think, a testament of his ability to convince you. I hate to say this is much of a con, but, you know, he was calling immediately, telling you, professing the love, wanting to keep the marriage together, and then you find out, no, he's still continuing the affair. Blatant, outright lies. And yet he had the ability to still have that little bit of charm that you fell in love with a long time ago.
I don't know that it was the charm. I think it was the trying to keep everything together. Our dream of building the kennel and the children. The children, I just didn't want them caught in this. I didn't want to ruin our family. Our family, it just meant everything to me. Thinking I would never have one and had a beautiful one. And I don't know. I would probably take a bunch of psychiatrists to figure this whole thing out. Mm-hmm. And yet there's still, like I said, some part of me that says I wish I knew the magic to make it work, to see, did I do something? Are you doing something? No, it just happens. It's just that he couldn't let go of the possessions, and that's why. So,
yeah.
I didn't think about how we were going to separate it. The attorneys did, and they informed me, and I said, it's okay. You know, this is what we're going to do. My head still was not, you know, thinking, what should we do? What shouldn't we do? They said, look at this is what we're thinking about. What do you think?
Yeah.
Okay. I have the properties. I can sell them. I have something yet, because somehow we have to live. I gave up my career. And I can't go back to it now.
Yeah, absolutely. You did what was best. That's very, very, very admirable.
No,
I think it's interesting, too, when we go back to your graduation gift and the palm reading, when the Mary said, if you have a long life, I mean, if you live, you will have a long life. So I guess she was right about a lot of things.
Yes, she
all
was.
All said and done.
Yes, she was. I have had... a long, you know, I've had a long life. I'm very lucky, and Mary was very right.
Yeah.
She was very right that if I live, I live a long time, and I've lived a long time, and I had a good life. You know, I was single 21 years and then got married and was married 22 years. So,
nice.
And I had a hard life. I had a hard life, and my children, they know what it is to work. They know the word bored. They would never, ever use the word be bored because they would have so many projects, they never use it again.
Mm-hmm.
I hear children nowadays talking about being bored. Well, and they all look at it, might look at each other, and they say, "I'm not in this house."
Yeah,
they all
absolutely.
They all had responsibilities, and they're good,
yes.
Good decent human beings and well educated. I'm very proud of that, and I'm proud that the girls didn't give up their education. You know, like I did, I gave up mine with the belief that, you know, this was going to happen. I got the top job in the class, and Marshall Fields wanted me to be a buyer. And at that time, all their buyers were from Princeton and Yale. And when they were talking to me to be a buyer, they kept saying, "Do you know what you're passing up?" And of course not. I'm getting married, and this is, how can you know? You can't look in the future. You know, I knew that, you know, that everyone was telling me that this is not offered to just anybody. Look at all these people that are their buyers.
Right.
You know, they come from a lot higher schooling than I had. And you're being offered this, you know, are you sure you want to give it up? No.
Yes. And you did. And you did
at that time,
you did give
I
it up.
Yes, you know, I.
You did give it up for the dream.
I was going to get married, and
red.
We were going to get finished his, and then we were going to start on mine.
Yeah.
Was,
I want to thank you, Nancy. I want to thank you, Nancy, for coming on and talking about Maybe You Die, the true story of a couple living the all-American nightmare. Thank you so much for sharing this very personal story. I know it's hard to go back and talk of the attack and this entire thing. But I want to thank you for sharing this story of Maybe You Die, the true story of a couple living the all-American nightmare. I know for people that might want to look, it's on Amazon, this book, but it's also on Apple Books, so people can look for that there. I want to thank you very much, Nancy, for this interview. I want to thank you very much, and you have a great evening.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Good night.
Good night.